Lot. Thanks for coming. Again, I'm going to tell you about some studies of quantum criticality and antiferromagnets. Roger is one of my collaborators, and I should acknowledge him right here. And also Matt Block, who is one of my postdocs, and Anders Sandvik, who I've worked with a lot. I'm just going to give you a little introduction into spin models and why I think this is interesting. And then I'll tell you about the sign problem, which I'm very interested in and I've studied a lot. And I'll tell you about some simple progress we made. It's very simple, but very interesting, I think, in finding out ways to write models that don't have the sign problem. The goal, this is one part, big part of my research, is I'd like to understand the sign problem better. And finally, I'll show you that these models that we've invented are actually useful for studying some real physics and some actually very non-trivial gauge theories that you can study actually by studying these quantum models. Okay, so it all comes together quite nicely. So let me begin with the introduction, and I know this is going to be trivial for many of you, but relax. So we'll begin with two spin halves, okay? So this is very simple. And this is a picture of Heisenberg. This is a Heisenberg interaction between two spins. And you all know you can diagonalize this. The ground state of this is a singlet, and the excited state is a triplet. Okay, so the singlet is it's unusual because if you had classical spins, any configuration that the classical spins are in breaks rotational symmetry. But the interesting thing about the singlet is it preserves rotational symmetry. And this is going to be very important for what I talk about. So even though this is very simple physics, it actually has very profound consequences. Okay, a spin model is just the lattice of, on some regular lattice, you have spins on each side, and the spins interact with each other. And even though the spins only interact in a pairwise way with each other, to solve this model, or lattice model on a big lattice, you have to diagonalize in principle a 2 raised to n to 2 raised to n matrix. Okay, so even if n is 100, 2 to the 100 is a gigantic number, and it's something that basically brute force no computer can solve. Or you can solve by analytic methods. But I just want to emphasize that this history of solving spin models has a long history in physics. So the first sort of solution of a spin model was in one dimension. And again, I apologize, I haven't given people credit here for all the things they did. But these are so famous that I'm sure you all know what this is. So in 1931, Hans Bethe showed that you can solve the one-dimensional spin chain. And then in the 80s, people got an interest in the square lattice Heisenberg model. And that, in 1980s, they showed that it was nail-ordered. And then if you take it and make it even more complicated, like you put on a Kagome lattice, then there's been a lot of controversy. And it seems to be that it's somewhat settled now. And it took all the way in 2010 of doing DMRG by Steve White and his collaborators, where they showed that this was spin liquid. So I just want to emphasize that there's a long history of studying spin models. They're very fundamental and basic. And even though they're so simple to write down, I basically explained to you what a spin model is in two slides. They're very, very complicated to solve, and they've inspired all kinds of interesting analytic and numerical concepts. Okay, so I want to give you an introduction to quantum critical spin models. So this is what a spin model is, and it's very hard to solve. So what is a quantum critical spin model? So I'll illustrate this by a very simple example. So this is the so-called bilayer antiferromagnet. Okay, so maybe some of you are familiar with this. The idea is that you have spins on two sets of square lattices. So you have a set of square lattice which is on one layer and then another layer. And all the spins in one layer are coupled with some exchange constant J. So that's a Heisenberg interaction. And then there's a Heisenberg interaction between the planes. Okay, so there are two parameters, J, perp, and J. And as you know, if you're only interested in the ground state properties, there's only one parameter, which is the ratio. And so if you tune this ratio, you make it very large, then you form these intra-rung singlets. And if you make this not infinite, but large but finite, then this singlet state is stable. Okay, and the important thing, now remember we discussed, is that because singlets are rotationally symmetric, this ground state wave function preserves rotational symmetry. Okay, now if you go to the other end, then, I'll talk about this, and this is going to be an important part of my talk. If you take a single layer, it turns out to have magnetic order. Okay, so this is the thing that was established in the 1980s. Both through analytic calculations and numerical simulations. And this is nail order. So imagine you take a square lattice and you break the lattice up into black and white sides. So this is a standard bipartition. And you put all the spins on one sublattice up and on the other sublattice down, then you get the nail state. So if you take two nail states and you couple them weakly, then the nail order is stable, and it'll stay stable for some region. So the interesting thing is, in these two limits, you have a different symmetry breaking pattern. So over here, you don't break any symmetry, and in this limit, you break rotational symmetry. And so this is an example of a quantum critical point, because when you tune this parameter, at some point, this symmetry breaking must vanish. Okay, and this was originally studied by various people, both in the context of this model and in terms of field theory, and is one of the seminal studies of quantum critical phenomena. Now, it turns out that the actual critical point in this particular model happens to be very simple, or it's not simple, but it is actually very well understood in terms of classical critical phenomena. And the thing I'd like to talk to you about today actually has no analog in classical critical phenomena, but I'll come to that in a second. Now, so this is a very simple example of a quantum critical spin system, okay? And this is what the talk is going to be about, is understanding such quantum critical spin systems. And why are we interested in understanding them is because they're a major challenge for theorists. Because at the critical point, you have a strongly interacting many-body problem in which there are no small parameters, you can't do mean field theory. But still, there's this concept of universality. Okay, and the idea is very similar to what happens in classical critical phenomena, is that even though the system is so strongly interacting and strongly fluctuating, there are certain aspects of the system which don't depend on the details of the model in which you realize the critical point. It just depends on some very general properties of the system. Okay, so I'm actually going to study lots of universal properties and show you how these things can be calculated. Okay, so the main question, physics question, that we're going to be interested in today is we want to do exactly the same thing that we had for the bilayer, but we want to do it on a single layer. Okay, so now imagine you have a single layer. You have the Heisenberg model. And now, you know, if you take spins, we discussed that it has this nail state which breaks rotational symmetry. And so in the bilayer, what we did is we made two copies of these nail states, and then we coupled them together, and we saw with strong coupling it forms this non-magnetic state. So this critical point. So we want to ask exactly the same question, but now for a single layer. Okay, so we want to ask that suppose you take the single layer model, and you add some quantum fluctuations, and you increase these quantum fluctuations, how does this magnetic state get destroyed, and what kind of non-magnetic state do you get, and what kind of critical point do you get? Okay, now I want to emphasize that even at, just by looking at this model at a cartoon level, it's actually much more complicated than the bilayer. Okay, and the reason is that in the bilayer, there's a unique way to decompose the system into singlets, right? You can just decompose the singlets vertically, and doing that doesn't break any symmetry of the system. Okay, but on a single layer, there's no way to decompose the system into pairwise singlets without breaking some symmetry of the system, okay, in a static way. So one solution to this was the famous idea of Anderson, which is called the resonating valence bond, RVB. And what he conjectured is that you could have a state which has spin zero. Now remember, singlet states have spin zero. So if I construct wave functions from singlet states, that's one way to have a wave function which has spin zero. But his idea was that this was completely quantum mechanical. So we'll take a quantum superposition of many singlet coverings. So imagine you have all kinds of singlet coverings in the system, and we're going to have a superposition of all these singlet coverings. Okay, so this is what is referred to as a spin liquid. And so this could be one ground state of the square lattice antiferromagnet. Okay, another ground state, which is simpler, is a so-called valence bond solid, in which these neighboring spins form singlets, but they do in a regular pattern. But now the interesting thing is that this pattern has to break some symmetry of the square lattice. So unlike the liquid state, which fluctuates, in the solid, these things are just regularly arranged. And so there's 1, 2, 3, 4 different ways in which you can form a solid on the square lattice. Okay, and in fact, this number 4 actually depends on the lattice, and that's going to be a very important aspect of what I'll tell you towards the end of the talk. Okay, so now imagine that these quantum fluctuations are so large, the system forms a valence bond solid. And now you could imagine, now you could ask yourself, how do you go from the nail state to the valence bond solid? And you might think that, well, so the first important thing is, it's not as simple as the case of the bilayer, because the valence bond solid breaks symmetry, as I just discussed. It breaks rotational symmetry. And the nail state breaks spin rotational symmetry. So this breaks lattice rotational symmetry, and this breaks spin rotational symmetry. And so it's not possible to write a simple critical point to go from the nail state to the valence bond solid. So you might think the simplest solution to this is that you have some intermediate state, which is like an RBB spin liquid, and you could then have continuous transitions from the nail state and the VBS state into this RBB spin liquid. But there was a very interesting idea in 2004 that actually this need not happen, and you can have a direct transition between the nail state and the valence bond solid. So it's almost like the whole RBB state gets squeezed into a single point. So the RBB state, and the reason that this happens in this theory, and I'll discuss the theory a little bit with you later because it's slightly technical, but it's important for understanding the last part, is that in 2+1 dimension, this spin liquid that they studied actually is unstable to valence bond solid ordering. Okay, so you can't actually have this. So the minute nail order goes away, VBS order has to come on. And the way it comes on is by having this critical point, which is very exotic. Okay, so this critical point is very different from the standard O3 critical point. It's described in terms of some emergent gauge fields. It's described in terms of a gauge theory called the CPN model. Okay, so I'll tell you what this is. It's going to be very important, and I'll describe it in detail in a little bit. Okay, I've just sort of sketched this scenario that these people came up with in 2004, and it's speculative because it had to make all kinds of assumptions about the field theory in order to exist, and so it's very important for us to be able to test this scenario to know whether it's true, and we want to do this in real microscopic models. Okay, so now the problem is that we have to figure out terms which we can add to. So the Heisenberg models, you know, we all know doesn't have a sign problem. We can study it with Monte Carlo. But generically, when you add terms to Heisenberg model, they create sign problems. And so the question is, how can we study this nail to VBS transition in the model without a sign problem? Okay, so,
So the fact that you have spin a half degrees of freedom, is that important? Let's say if you had 3/2 spin.
Mm-hmm.
Do people know whether there's a similar story to this
world? Yeah, so I think, what I'm going to show you is, at least in the spin half case, we've studied this numerically in great detail, and we can almost answer every question about it. When it's not spin half, there are theoretical expectations, but they haven't been tested yet. So, for instance, you have a four-fold degenerate state here, right? So the statement is that the ground state is degenerate. How do I say it? So for even integer spin, you can have a non-degenerate state. So you're maybe all familiar that if you take spin 2 spins on the square lattice, you can have a non-degenerate state. It's like generalization of AKLT. If you have spin 1s on a square lattice, you have to have a two-fold degenerate ground state. Okay, so it's like forming a Haldane chains spontaneously. So you have to choose either to do it this way or that way, and that's what creates two-fold degeneracy. Spin 3/2 has to have a four-fold degeneracy. So spin 3/2 actually is very similar to spin half. And one believes this is very similar to what happens in one dimension, that there's a periodicity. But unlike in one dimension where the periodicity is even odd, here it happens in multiples of four. So you have spin 0, spin half, spin 1, spin 3/2, and then it repeats itself again. Now this hasn't been tested fully, and I think it's something interesting to do, but one believes this is true. So in general, analytic solutions for these kind of spin models are not available. We know this in 2+1 dimension. And the only way we can study this in higher dimension is by doing a quantum Monte Carlo. Okay, so there's no other method which can study big systems in two dimensions in an unbiased way. Okay, not yet, anyway. So now, unfortunately, the problem with Monte Carlo is it suffers from the sign problem. Okay, so generally, if you take a model, and I'll talk about what the sign problem is. So now what I want to tell you is a little bit about the sign problem and how we can get around the sign problem in lots of models. Okay, so the idea of the sign problem is you take Z, it's trace exponent minus beta H, and you want to study the thermal partition function. So you rewrite the thermal partition function as a sum over configurations over some weight. Okay, so the sign problem just refers to the fact that, you know, you have to do this in some way. So you have to go from trace exponent minus beta H to sum of configurations in some way. And in general, these weights, the sign of the weights can fluctuate. Okay, so if the sign of the weights can fluctuate, this Hamiltonian H is said to have a sign problem. Okay, and the reason it's called a problem, I mean, of course, the reason it's called a sign is just because the signs can change. And the reason it's called a problem is because And this is sort of technical, and you know, Roger and I wrote this review article where we explain exactly why this happens. It's not very hard, but it's sort of a detour from what I'm speaking about. But generally, when the signs change, Monte Carlo becomes it takes exponentially long for Monte Carlo to converge. So if a model has a sign problem, it doesn't mean you can't simulate it with Monte Carlo. It just means it's exponentially difficult. So it takes a lot of computer time. And it's basically impractical for most things. Okay? Now, luckily for us, there are a few models which we have, which if we take z trace exponent minus beta h, we know ways to write it as a sum over all positive weights. Okay, so such models we'll say are sign problem free. And they're very, very important because they're the only examples of models we have right now which in higher dimension we can simulate in unbiased way in polynomial time. Okay, so it's of great interest to understand you know, what models are sign problem free, at least to me. So one way to get a model which is sign problem free is to make sure the Hamiltonian satisfies Marshall's sign condition. Okay, so Marshall proved this theorem back in the 50s. It's a very interesting theorem, and basically the only input it actually requires two inputs. One is that the Hamiltonian, there is a basis in which the Hamiltonian has all off-diagonal matrix elements which are negative. So they're either equal to zero or they're negative. And this is called Marshall's sign condition. So if you have this condition, you have the condition that the Hamiltonian connects all of the basis states on repeated application, Marshall's theorem says that the Hamiltonian has, the ground state wave function has a positive expansion in this basis. But not only does the ground state wave function has a positive expansion, if this is true, it is always possible, trivially, to write this partition function as a sum of positive numbers. Okay, so I want to emphasize that just satisfying Marshall's sign condition is not the only way in which you can solve the sign problem, but it's definitely the most common way and the most convenient way. In fact, the way that's used most of the time for all spin models. So I got interested in this question, and I wanted to ask myself a very simple question. Okay, is that we know that most sign spin models are not Marshall positive, in the sense that we don't know simple bases in which the off-diagonal matrix elements are negative. Now, we know that many interesting ones are, for instance, the SU2 antiferromagnet. So is there a systematic way in which we can write down all the models that have satisfy Marshall's sign theorem? Okay, so if we can write down all these models, then we have a large family of models we can simulate without a sign problem, right? Because if they satisfy Marshall's sign theorem, they can be written as a sum of positive weights. Okay, so now, of course, spin models are a very general class, and they're all kinds of different things. So we have to restrict ourselves a little bit. And so in order to restrict myself and focus, I'm going to talk about bipartite SUN antiferromagnets. Okay, and the reason that this class is interesting is they connect very closely to deconfined criticality. So this will connect this part of the talk with the first part of the talk, and I'll connect that with concrete simulations. Okay, so I'm asking a very concrete question. I have an SUN antiferromagnet, and if you put n equal to 2, you get an SU2 antiferromagnet, which is your familiar Heisenberg model. And I want to ask, what is the most general model I can write down that doesn't have a sign problem? Okay, so let me first review before I did this work, what was known about sign problem-free models with spins. Okay, so there was this SU2 antiferromagnet, which was known not to have a sign problem. And actually, this goes back in some sense to Marshall's work in 1955. So Marshall, when he first proved this theorem, he proved it for the SU2 antiferromagnet. Okay, so he showed that this model satisfies Marshall's sign condition. And this was exploited by Rieger and Young in 1988 to simulate this model for the first time and show there was nail order. I think there were other methods by which people had guessed it was nail order, but this was the first numerical simulation which showed it. Okay, so then there was a very interesting idea by Ian Affleck in late 90s, is that you know, he was thinking about, at that point, people were thinking of ways to solve these models, and instead of taking the large S limit, he said that, well, you can generalize SU2 to SUN. So it's not just that you increase the size of representation, but you actually change the nature of the symmetry. But he wanted to do it in a way in which you could have two-site singlets. So what he said is that let's take all these black sites, put them in the fundamental representation of SUN, and let's take all the white sites and put them in the conjugate to fundamental. Okay? So now if you consider interactions between two spins, they're of the form T times T star, okay, because the conjugate representation is like taking the conjugate of the generator. And now if you put n equal to 2 in this formula, you get back your Heisenberg model. So even though this is a minus sign, actually it's a Heisenberg antiferromagnet because of the star. And you see that the interesting thing is that this model, actually for all values of n, is Marshall sign positive. It satisfies Marshall sign theorem. And I'll show you why in a second. It may not be obvious by looking at it like this, but if you rewrite in another way, it becomes obvious. Naoki Kawashima and Matthias Troyer and Kenji Harada studied this model as a function of n. So this is like a Heisenberg model as a function of n. And they showed that when n is very large, it becomes a VBS. So actually, n has to be larger than 5. When n is smaller than 5, it's a nail state. Okay, so I'll come back to the physics of this. So there are two examples so far. I have the SU2 model, then I have the generalization to SUN. And then there was this very interesting idea by Anders Sandvik, where he said that you can construct a Q model. Okay, so the Q model is just, you take the J model, and you know the J model is Marshall positive. So you start taking products of the J terms. So if you have a plaquette, you can have a J term between these two sides. And because each of the J terms is positive, each of them is negative. If you take a product of the two, it's positive. But then if you have a minus sign, it's negative. And that's basically how Sandvik constructed this model, which also satisfies Marshall's sign theorem. Okay, so this is when I got involved in this project with Roger. This figure is from our paper, where we studied this model back in the day. So now the question that I want to ask is that we have this Heisenberg model, we have the Affleck model, we have Anders's Q term. What is the most general term that we can write down which doesn't have a sign problem for this model? Okay, so how do we make this a systematic construction? Yep. So did you mean like?
Because the O n representation is real, so your technique is to like use fundamental and hypothetical.
Yeah, so I mean I think you have to. Usually when we think of spin models, we think of SUN, but maybe you're talking about like, are you talking about a classical model or something?
Model.
Yeah, so the classical vector model is sign problem free because the action is real. So if you exponentiate it, it's always positive. But you can actually define ON spin models, but I think I can tell you about that maybe later. I think that's slightly different. But usually in the context of quantum spins, we have SUN spins. Okay, so the interesting, so how do we define, find a most general Marshall positive model? Okay, so the idea which I just put up recently on the archive is very simple, and it's that if you think of the imaginary time statistical mechanics of these models, they actually map to a certain kind of loop model. Okay, so they're tightly packed, unoriented loop models with n colors, where the loop have n colors. Okay, so let me show you how that works. So if you take this Affleck interaction, right, this TT star model, it's very easy to see that it doesn't have a sign problem because you can rewrite it in a certain way. So you have to work on a bipartite lattice. And if you have, now you have n colors on each side of your bipartite lattice. So if you consider between A and B, you can construct a singlet, S, which is a sum on, now alpha, these are the colors of the two sides. We say you have two sides A and B, and these colors range from 1 to n. So if you sum over these, then this gives you an SUN singlet, okay? Because if I take S and I multiply, now remember I have to multiply by U on the A sublattice and U star on the B sublattice, that leaves this object invariant, okay? So that's how this is an SUN singlet. And so this Hamiltonian actually is just a singlet projector. Okay, so if you put n equal to 2, this becomes the familiar fact that the Heisenberg model is a singlet projector. Okay, but it's a singlet projector with a minus sign. And because the singlet has a positive expansion in the basis, it's guaranteed actually now that all off-diagonal matrix elements are negative. Okay, so this is how Affleck's term actually proves that you don't have a sign problem.
So the alphas are eigenvalues of the Cartan matrices?
No. I'm sorry. So this notation might be confusing. So I have a lattice. And it's very simple. I'm defining quantum mechanics on the lattice. And on each side, my Hilbert space is specified by specifying the color on a side. And the color sticks n values from 1 to n. And alpha indexes those colors.
So the t's are generators of SUN.
Right, yeah. So t has both the Cartan, the diagonal and off-diagonal terms.
Right.
And I'm going to sum over all of them.
Right. Some of them are Hopkins, others are just the diagonal guys.
Yeah.
My question was, the alphas are not, if this is SU2 and the alpha is the eigenvalues of SZ,
They're either eigenvalues of SZ.
Okay.
It's the dimensionality of, it's just the dimensionality of the representation. Okay, so now the interesting thing is if you take this and you look at the imaginary time statistical mechanics, right? So imagine taking this interaction, and then you could do the stochastic series expansion on a path integral. Then what you see is actually you have, if you work with a d-dimensional quantum mechanical model, you'll get a d plus one-dimensional classical statistical mechanic model, but it'll be a model of loops. Okay, and the important thing is that these loops are oriented. So the way this interaction works is that if you go up on the A sublattice and you follow the loops, you always go down on the B sublattice, and you always go up. So basically, the structure of the loops maintains the orientation. So if you decide that, you know, it's a, there's one arbitrariness, you have to decide whether the loops are going up or down on the A sublattice. But once you fix that, then the orientation of all the loops actually is determined. So this is referred to as an oriented loop model. You can have an unoriented loop model, and that's related to O-N spin models. But if you have oriented loop models on bipartite lattices, they have SUN symmetry. So now, actually, the interesting thing is that this model is a classical statistical mechanical model which has a real action and it has positive weights, because each of these configurations that weight the loop model comes with a positive weight. Okay, the reason it comes with a positive weight is you have a minus sign here and you have a minus sign in the Hamiltonian and they give you a plus sign. So what you can do now is you can take any set of spins and you can draw these loop configurations and ask, you know, you can reconnect the loops with positive weights. And if you reconnect the loops with positive weights and you sum over all loop colors, you're guaranteed that the model will be SUN symmetric. Okay, so you can do this for SU2, but you can do this for any n. And, you know, you can just do some simple cases. So if you take two spins and the spins are on different sublattices, now the only way to reconnect the loops, so of course you could have nothing happen, in which case this will just continue to go up and this will continue to go down. But if you want something to happen, the only thing you can have is that you have this up going down and the down going up. Okay, so this is this Affleck interaction or the Heisenberg model for n equal to 2. And now if you had spins on the same sublattice, so say you take black and black, then if you're going up on this lattice, you can continue to go up on this lattice, and you can continue to go up on this lattice, and then this is like a ferromagnetic Heisenberg interaction. Okay, so it's not surprising the ferromagnetic Heisenberg interaction doesn't have a sign problem because it doesn't frustrate the nail state. Okay, so now if you think about this Q interaction, the Q interaction actually just takes the simple picture because it's just the product of two J terms. Okay, but now you see that you can construct another four-spin interaction, which is SUN invariant. Okay, so I call it R because R is a alphabet that comes after Q. And so it looks like the Q interaction, but it's rotated. So you have two loops coming over here, and then you have two loops which are rotated by 90 degrees. Okay, so there's a simple physical interpretation for what this R term is. So if you consider the Q interaction is, you know, because it's a product of projector onto singlets, it actually has a very close analogy with the quantum dimer model. Is that if you take the Q interaction, it's like a diagonal attractive interaction between singlets. So you have two singlets and it takes it to two singlets. But this R interaction is like the resonating term in the quantum dimer model. So if you take two singlets which are, you know, horizontally oriented, when they act with the R interaction quantum mechanically, they become vertically oriented. And you can actually show that this is not just like a pictorial connection, but if you take the large n limit of the SUN spin model, they actually map exactly to quantum dimer models. And so there's this interesting connection now where we see this Q interaction that Sandvik introduces only one term of this sort of quantum dimer representation that you get at large n. Okay, so the interesting thing.
If you were to go back to fermions to derive this spin Hamiltonian, right, for a strong coupling extension, that would be one of the terms in the Wiggins change extension, right?
Right.
I guess I
haven't actually. I should know the answer to this. So let me just say that. So if you have four spins, and actually maybe it's on the next slide a little bit here. If you have four spins, and you want to maintain rotational symmetry, there are only two independent terms you can write down. Okay, so you can. I mean, first of all, if you take four spins and you want to make something SU2 invariant, you have to take S dot S times S dot S. And if you want a rotationally invariant, then you have to add this. So this is a Q term. And then the other term is something which has diagonal bonds for S dot S, right? So there are only two independent numbers you can tune. So I've decided to parameterize it in terms of Q and R because then it becomes very simple. So if you parameterize the most general four-spin interaction which preserves the rotational symmetry in terms of Q and R, It's in this region, it doesn't have a sign problem. Okay, but every other term which you get, including the point that you're referring to, which you would get from the Hubbard model, lies somewhere in this plane. My guess is it lies somewhere in the region with a sign, but I haven't checked that. I remember it had the wrong, so if you do the derivation, I remember it had the wrong sign of Q. That's what people said originally when Sandvik discovered the Q model. That's why I think it's maybe somewhere in this quadrant.
Q is equal to R, but maybe on the third quadrant.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I think you're right. It's right. Probably somewhere over here is my guess. Yeah. So anyway, so of course it's useful that we can derive these new terms. And now, you know, by drawing these simple loop pictures, we can extend this to any number of spins. So if you had six spins, you could write down the most general interaction with six spins, that is SU2 invariant, or eight spins. And so there's this large family of models, and the set of models, so this is kind of like a family of models, and includes all the models we know which don't have sign problems, but also has many, many new models which don't have sign problems. And so something I was discussing with people yesterday is I hope that, you know, now that we can quantify these models that don't have sign problems, we can maybe try and prove something about what kind of ground states they can have. So we know that they can have nail states, and we know they can have BBS states. But I think the big question is whether they can have spin liquid states. And maybe it's possible to prove that they can't. So of course, Roger studied models that do, but they don't have SUN symmetry. They're like U1 models. So one of the questions that, you know, has been a big question in our field is whether we can find models which have spin liquids, which are sign problem free for SU2. So if you assume that this set of models is a complete set of models, okay, so we don't know any exception, and it may be that we'll find that there are other models, but right now if we just assume these includes all the models, it's a very large class of models, it's interesting to ask whether we can prove at least in this class whether it's not possible to have a spin liquid. So one thing we could do is, of course, we can go and simulate these models, and there's infinitely many couplings, so that's too much work. So it'll be interesting if we can try and prove it at the level of a theorem. So the question really is, in some sense, if you have these models of classical statistical mechanics with oriented loops on a bipartite lattice, what kind of ground states can they have? Okay, so we know they can have a nail state, which corresponds to having phases with very long loops. And we know they can have VBS states, which corresponds to very short loop phases that break rotational symmetry. The question is whether they can have anything in between. So it appears if you have unoriented loops that you can have spin liquids. Okay, so that's something that I'm studying, but I won't really tell you about today. Okay, so this was all of the stuff about these models, and now I want to show you that studying these models, and of course I presented it like, you know, in the systematic way, but some of these terms, as you know, were known before I did this. Yeah, this is in two dimensions, but you can do it in any dimension. Yeah, you can do it in any dimension.
Is it a technique-dependent statement? Like, you use SSE, right? Or back integral?
So the interesting thing is it does dip. So it's I'm still using the simple basis. So I'm using, you know, Marshall has a simple trick where he rotates by pi around one sublattice. So I've generalized that to SUN, and I'm using that basis. And I'm asking what's the most general Hamiltonian that basis. Now you could wonder whether in a different basis you could have solved some other models that don't have sign problems. But no one's been able to do this yet. I mean, people keep saying this, but no one's ever been able to find a model which you can only solve in one basis and not in the other.
But like, for instance, if you track like Green's function Monte Carlo, do you expect the same?
I think so, yeah. So I think if you look at Green's function Monte Carlo or stochastic series or path integral, they all come down in the end to proving Marshall's sign theorem, to proving that they're sign problem free. So I don't think it depends on the method, but I think that in each of them you have to choose a basis, and it may depend on the basis, but the best of our knowledge, these are the only ones we know. Okay, so maybe in the last 15 minutes of this talk, I'll show you so we call these designer Hamiltonians because they're Hamiltonians which, so, you know, for instance, you write down the Hubbard model, not because it describes a particular material, but because it's simple to write down analytically. Okay, but it's very hard to solve numerically. So our approach is to try and write down models which are easy to solve numerically. Okay, because the idea is we want to solve some many-body problem. And, you know, we all realize that, you know, actually describing an experiment is very difficult. So instead of writing and in some sense, you know, the Hubbard model is simple to write analytically, but it's not simple to solve analytically. So why not write some models which we can solve numerically? Okay, and so this large family of models is one set now which we can solve, because they don't have a sign problem in polynomial time on a computer. Okay, so we can solve them very efficiently. And again, this is from our little review article we wrote. And so this is a phase diagram with some of these couplings. So I've not used all the couplings. Of course, there are infinitely many couplings. But it turns out that for SUN antiferromagnets on a square lattice, and actually all the lattices that I'll talk about, we only need two couplings to tune between the nail and VBS. Okay, so now let's get out of the sign problem and go back to the original problem of the antiferromagnet. And we had the nail state and the VBS state. And what we want to do is, for every value of n, is we want to tune between the nail state and the VBS state. And so if you just take the Heisenberg model, this Affleck interaction, as a function of n, for small n, it's nail ordered, which is blue. And for large n, it becomes VBS ordered, which is gray. Okay, so now by introducing these couplings for any value of n, we can tune ourselves to the critical point between nail and VBS. Again, we've simulated them on very large systems, and there's basically very good evidence that this transition is just continuous between nail and VBS. Okay, but now we can connect with a very non-trivial study of a field theory which is believed to describe these critical points. Okay, so I mentioned this briefly, and I'll talk about it a little bit more because it's going to be important for the final part. But the continuum theory of the critical point is supposed to be described by the CPN field theory. Okay, so CPN field theory is a theory of n complex scalars coupled to one U1 gauge field. Okay, so this has a long history in condensed matter. Halperin, Lubensky, and Ma in 1974 were the first people who actually studied the critical phenomena in this theory. But since then, it's been studied by many people in various different contexts. It's a lattice. One application of it is it's a model for the superconducting transition, because you can think of Z as superconducting order parameter, and because superconducting order parameter is charged, it's coupled to the gauge field of light, and so this is a model for superconductors, but also connects to phase transitions in liquid crystals, and in this context today, to phase transitions in antiferromagnets. Okay, so you can. Now, unfortunately, this model is also very hard to study, this field theory, but people have studied in the large n limit. Okay, so in fact, Halperin, Lubensky, and Ma originally studied it. And you can calculate scaling dimensions of various operators. And now, using the deconfined criticality scenario, you can connect those critical exponents to exponents of the magnet. So you have a spin operator, you have a VBS operator, and they all have correlation functions and scaling dimensions. And we can make connections between the two. And we can see, now that we can simulate the system at finite values of n, we can actually compare with the large n expansions that you can calculate in the field theory. Okay, and some of these, calculating the VBS scaling dimension actually connects to, field theory aficionados, it connects to scaling dimension of monopole operators in the gauge theory. Okay, so people have been able to calculate the scaling dimension of monopole operators. In fact, this is something that string theorists have worked on too. And I should actually cite Anton Kapustin here, because he did some very pioneering work in calculating some of these scaling dimensions using conformal field theory techniques. Okay, so in any case, for large n, the nail anomalous dimension, once you make the connection between the CPN theory and the magnet, the nail anomalous dimension is given by 1 minus 32 divided by pi squared divided by n. Okay, so where n goes to infinity, the anomalous dimension of the nail field goes to 1. Okay, so this is a very unusual thing, because normally when you have critical phenomena, in the large n limit, anomalous dimension goes to 0 because you become more mean field-like. But here what happens is, because you're fractionalized, the z's have no anomalous dimension. But when you construct the nail order parameter, which is a composite of z particles, it gets an anomalous dimension even when n is infinity. Okay, and the VBS anomalous dimension actually grows with n. And in fact, I think Silvio Pufu and some of his collaborators have now managed to calculate, Subir, now the people have calculated the next correction to this term. And we're waiting, because I'm going to show you that we've been able to calculate these things with our computer simulations. Okay, so now if I take these sign problem-free models, I tune them to the critical point for each value of n, I can extract the anomalous dimension of the nail field and the VBS field. And now I can plot it as a function of n. Okay, so here I've plotted as a function of 1 over n. And this red line is the 1 over n expansion. Okay, so these things agree. So this is for the JQ model, and this is for this J1, J2 model. So I didn't have time to tell you in detail what these models are. But they're sort of design models that allow us to reach the critical point. Okay, and so in these insets, I've tried to, so these numbers are very non-trivial, 32 divided by pi square. And this 2 delta 1, of which we don't, even with Kapustin's work, actually, in the end, you have to solve it numerically. So we don't know the analytic form of this number, but we know its value is about 0.1246. And here, I'm plotting 2 times delta 1, which is like 0.1246 into 2. And this is our numerical data for finite values of n. If we extrapolate, it agrees very well with this large n result. Okay, so all of this shows very consistently that something very beautiful, I think, is that we have this model of spins, a quantum model. And when we reach the critical point, somehow we have this emergent description in terms of this very non-trivial gauge theory, which we can study at large n. Okay, so there are various consistencies we've checked between the CPN theory and our numerical simulations. They all agree very well. And as I said, that we've even been able to fit our data. So if you fit, so for instance, if you look at this plot in the inset, the slope of this plot actually tells you the next 1 over n square correction to these anomalous dimensions. And this is something that people are calculating, and I hope that from our work, this is with Sandvik, that you know, we've predicted these things and they can be measured.
So the VPS phases, you have all these models, they are all VPS of the shortest wavelength?
They're all columnar VPS.
Yeah,
the columnar VPS, yeah. So they're just the shortest, simplest VPS. So in fact, we've been trying to find models which have different VBSs. In fact, that's one of the things that, so even if we can't find a spin liquid, we hope with all these design interactions, we can find different VBSs at least. I'm pretty confident we can do that, actually. Spin liquid remains to be seen, and maybe possible.
So what n can you reach? 5 or?
N? Yeah, the largest one, I think, is 10.
And beyond that, you just merge.
Yeah, you know, it's not impossible, actually. We just, it's, so what happens actually to this, especially this, is I'm plotting over here this eta, and this eta starts to get very large. And so what it means is that the correlation function, remember, which is 1 plus eta, decays very quickly. And it's very hard for us to measure it in numerical simulation. But there are also problems with ergodicity when you increase n. So I think we can go to larger n, actually. We haven't pushed it as hard as we can, but it's in principle doable. It never has a sign problem.
Which correlation function would you measure?
Maybe I can tell you that a little later. I think it's a little, so of course, you know, for SU2, it's just S dot S, which gives you the spin correlation function. But once you take SUN, actually the order parameter is, it's a traceless Hermitian matrix. So even for SU2, you know, because it happens that SU2 is similar to O3, so you can think of the SU2 order parameter as a O3 vector. That's how you have SX, SY, Z. But once you go beyond n equal to 2, you know, the correct way to think about it is it's a traceless Hermitian matrix. And you can define it on the lattice and measure it just like, and we've actually written this up, I can send it to you. And then for the VBS, we measure bond-bond correlation functions. And you have to Fourier transform them to the ordering vector and study the height of the peak. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm skipping over. This is like many years of work, so I'm skipping over lots of the details of how these things were done. Just telling you the story. Okay, so, I have maybe 10 minutes left, so I'll be quick and tell you about this last part that I worked on with Roger. And I think from the field theory point of view, this last part is very interesting. So for this, I have to tell you a little bit about this deconfined criticality scenario. Okay, so this is Ken Wilson's idea of, you know, renormalization group flow. And I want to show you how these guys generalize it to deconfined criticality. So Wilson's idea is that, you know, you have fixed points in which in your infinite dimensional space of Hamiltonians, every perturbation is irrelevant. Okay, and then you have a critical point in which you have one direction which is relevant, but every other direction is irrelevant. So if you draw these and, you know, you start drawing flow diagrams, this is the way the flow diagram has to end up. So the question is, now this fixed point usually describes order, and this fixed point describes disorder, and a critical point is a relevant direction between these two. So now if you take your model and you tune it across, you know, some line in your infinite dimensional Hilbert Hamiltonian space, then in this red region, you flow into this fixed point. The blue region, you flow into this fixed point. And when you just cross the critical surface, you flow at the critical point. Okay, so this is what happens in the 1 plus 1 dimensional Ising model. It's what happens in the bilayer model. But it turns out the flow diagram is much more complicated for deconfined criticality. Okay, and so I have to go a little technical again. And, you know, it's going to be a little hard to understand this all of it maybe so quickly unless you're familiar with it. So excuse me, but if you take a square lattice, SU an antiferromagnet, and you look for the continuum theory of the antiferromagnet, it's described in terms of CPN theory. Okay, so CPN theory in some sense also has an SUN symmetry because you can rotate amongst these, the colors, this index alpha. But the important thing, which was first figured out by Haldane and then Reed and Suchdev, is that if you derive this theory from a lattice antiferromagnet on the square lattice, there's some constraints on the kind of topological defects that you can have in the gauge field. Okay? So if you look at the gauge field in 2 plus 1 dimensions, its topological defects are monopoles. So if you integrate the flux of the gauge field on a sphere around a monopole, it's quantized. And what they showed is that if you take a square lattice, this gauge field can have monopoles only of charge 4. So there can be multiples of 4 because you can have two monopoles come together. But if you integrate the flux on a sphere around this topological defect, see, it has to be 2 pi times q, and q has to be 4 on a square lattice. So if you have any configuration which has q different from 4, then that configuration actually doesn't contribute to your partition function. And the reason is that you have destructive, if you take that configuration and you move the monopole around, you get destructive interference from all the different configurations, and all those phases cancel. Okay, but if you have q equal to 4, then there's no phases that appear, and then you don't have destructive interference. So when you take the continuum limit, the only kind of topological defects you can have are monopoles of charge 4. So now, let's take the CPN theory. And this is really pioneering work, which actually originally was started by my colleague in Kentucky, Ganpati Murthy. But then Matrunik and Vishwanath in 2003 really nailed this down. And you know, the idea is that if you take this fugacity for these four-fold monopoles and you set it equal to 0, you have a theory with no monopoles. And what Matrunik and Vishwanath conjectured and studied numerically is that if you have no monopoles, you can still have a disordered phase. Okay, so this is very much like the question of the XY model. And if you don't have vortices in the two-dimensional XY model, then it's believed that you won't have a disordered phase, right? So if you suppress topological defects, you can't disorder an XY model. This is like the argument of Costas and Thouless. But interestingly, if you go to one higher dimension, and the topological defects of the O3 model in three dimensions are hedgehogs, which in this gauge theory correspond to monopoles, you can have a disordered phase. And this disordered phase is different from the disordered phase that you would have if you had monopoles. Okay, so if you turn the fugacity to 0, you have this fixed point. And now the deconfined criticality is supposed to be described by this fixed point. Now, unfortunately, in a real magnet, you always have finite monopole fugacity, right? So this was the main result of Duncan Haldane in 1989, is that if you take this CPN theory, you always have monopoles of charge 4, only this monopole. So now you could have fugacity for all different kinds of monopoles. You could have lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, lambda 4, all the way up to lambda infinity. In fact, I'm going to try and study the general phase diagram with all these different fugacities. But if you take a particular antiferromagnet on a square lattice, you only have lambda 4. All the other lambdas are 0. They have to be 0. Not just, they're tuned to 0 by the model. So it's broken in this phase, yeah. Yeah, so it's a good question. You know, I can't remember right now. So it has a continuous vacuo. I mean, so there's a continuous, the Goldstone modes in that. So there's some like remnant, like if you can ask a question for an antiferromagnet, SU2 antiferromagnet, it still has, you can rotate about the direction of the, so if you have an O3 vector, you have to choose which direction it points, but then you can also rotate around it, the direction in which it points. So that symmetry is not broken. It's unbroken even in the magnetic phase.
You don't see the discrete, broken discrete vector?
No. It has Goldstone modes. It has a continuous symmetry. I don't know if I'm answering your question.
No.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure actually. Maybe I shouldn't. I'm not sure what the answer to that question is. We can maybe discuss it later. So So you have this SUN symmetry breaking, which gives you this nailed state. And then you have this disordered state, which is like a photon phase, where you have Zs are gapped and you have a gapless photon. So now if you introduce this lambda 4, this photon phase gets confined. And the important sort of result from Reed and Sachdev is that you get this VBS order due to this confining of lambda 4. So now if you want to connect up all these, you know the different limits of this phase diagram, the only way you can do it is in this way. And this is the flow diagram of this deconfined criticality, which is what we want to really test in our numerical simulations. So important thing here is that right at the critical point, lambda 4 is irrelevant. Yeah, but it's a dangerously irrelevant operator, because if you go slightly away from the critical point, it becomes relevant and determines the ordered phase. So if you take your model, which has a generic, any spin model has some finite lambda 4, and you tune across in your Hamiltonian space, in this red region, you flow into the ordered state here. And in this blue region, you almost flow into the disordered phase. But now, because this disordered phase is unstable, so remember I said the RBB, this is like the RBB state. And the RBB state is unstable to formation of valence bond solid. You actually always end up going over here into the VBS. Right? So this is how you can get a continuous transition between nail and VBS and tune over here. So this is something I showed you that works on the square lattice, where this fugacity is lambda 4. But now I want to ask the question, when the fugacity Q is different from 4. So what if you have not 4-fold monofolds, but you have Q-fold monopoles, where Q can be 1, 2, or 3, or 5, or 6, or any number. And we want to ask if this fixed point, which exists without monopoles, whether it's stable to the introduction of Q-fold monopoles. OK, so there are two central assumptions that you need for deconfined criticality. One is the existence of this fixed point, and the second is the irrelevance of monopoles at this fixed point. And so we want to test both these things. And so this is the work that Roger and I and my postdoc, Matt Block, published this year. And what we want to think about is that we have this fixed point at many values of n by changing the number of colors of the Z field. And we have the number of monopoles that are allowed. So we have a fugacity for either single monopoles, double monopoles, triple monopoles, quadruple monopoles. In fact, someone was asking about spin 1, and it forms 2 degenerate states. So that, in principle, actually corresponds to having 2 monopoles and not 4 monopoles. So actually, the history of and I want to emphasize that this model actually has a long history in condensed matter physics. It's been studied in various ways for a long time, and actually, again, it appears in many different contexts. And so the fact that we can now, unfortunately, to actually simulate this by itself is very complicated. And people have tried, but it's very, very hard to do. And now, because of this interesting connection with antiferromagnets, and because we have these signed problem-free antiferromagnets, we can actually address the question of this irrelevance or relevance by studying the antiferromagnets. And I think it's kind of interesting that we can answer these questions about these gauge theories by studying some simple models. Yeah, so it's kind of opposite to the usual way in which you say, oh, we have a spin model and experiment, and then it's described by the deconfined theory of some deconfined phase of a gauge theory. But here we're doing the opposite. To try and address the gauge theory, we're actually studying the spin model too. So that's a great question. So N I can tune because I can make an SUN antiferromagnet. And how I'll tune Q, I'll tell you in a second. That's a very good question. So again, there are various limits of this phase diagram which are understood. So I is for irrelevant and R is for relevant. And so let me just tell you that this limit where you have infinite, you only allow infinite monopoles corresponds to non-compact case. And this again has been studied by a large number of people. And there's some controversy for n equal to 2, whether you have a continuous transition or first order transition. But I'm just going to go with the fact, which is consistent with what we've studied, is that this transition is continuous in this Q equal to infinity limit. Okay, so now if you take n equal to 1, this corresponds to what is called Dasgupta and Halperin duality, because you can take a single component Z field coupled to U1 gauge field and dualize it and make it equal to the XY model. Okay, so this was figured out by Dasgupta and Halperin. And then the introduction of Q-fold monopoles corresponds to introducing an anisotropy in the XY order parameter. And that's something which was studied in this famous paper, first in 2-dimension by Jose Kirkpatrick. I'm sure many of you have read that paper. But then in 3-dimensional study numerically by Fukigata and Okawa and Bikari et al. Okay, and what they see is that for Q equal to 1, 2, and 3, the introduction of these monopole operators is relevant. But for Q equal to 4 and larger, it's irrelevant. Okay, so this is something that was known before we did our work. And then at large n, you know, you can always solve the theory, and you can show that at large n, monopole insertion is always irrelevant for all monopoles. Okay, so now what I showed you on the square lattice is, you know, by comparing the critical exponents to CPN theory, I showed you the square lattice actually flows into this point, which means the introduction of monopoles is irrelevant at this fixed point. But
do you really mean irrelevant, or you mean dangerously irrelevant?
I mean dangerously irrelevant. So I'm talking just about irrelevance at the fixed point. So dangerous irrelevance generally refers to what happens when you move away from the fixed point. So in this sense, I'm just talking about irrelevance at the, so it's dangerously irrelevant. So now the question is, what happens for q equal to 1, 2, and 3? And the interesting thing is, for q equal to 1, 2, and 3, for n equal to 1, they're relevant. But at large n, we know they're irrelevant. So the question is, what happens over here? There must be some point, some finite value of n, where we can see this transition. And if we can see this transition, again, this is very strong evidence that this whole way of thinking about the problem is correct. Okay, so how do we study it? And this was Sung-Sik's question. And it turns out that there's a very simple connection between the charge, the monopole charge, and the degree of degeneracy in the valence bond solid. Okay, so for instance, if you take an antiferromagnet on honeycomb lattice, now remember, we can study this thing on any bipartite lattice. Instead of having a four-fold degenerate VBS, you have to have a three-fold degenerate VBS. That's the minimum degeneracy of the VBS on the honeycomb lattice. Likewise, if you study the rectangular lattice, you have obviously a two-fold degeneracy because of rectangular lattice. Remember, you have those four VBS states. You pick two of them specially because you're broken C4 rotation to C2. Right, so you have a two-fold degenerate. And then if you take the bilayer, you can have a completely non-degenerate state. So that's like studying q equal to 1. Right, so that's how you, by studying, you know, the nail to VBS transition on these various lattices, you can answer the question of, you know, monopole degeneracy in the field theory. Okay, so okay, maybe I should wrap up quickly now. So again, I studied the bilayer in detail, and there's a lot of work which goes into different phases in the bilayer. But the transition we're interested here is studied is the nail to VB valence bond liquid transition, so-called valence bond liquid, where you have this. It's just a simple phase where you have this inter-rung singlet. Okay, and actually, during the time I studied this, John Chalker and his group also studied a related model, and they have very similar results. Basically, that if you work on the bilayer, you always have introduction of the bilayer interactions always relevant at this non-compact CPN fixed point for all values of n. Okay, then so this bilayer was q equal to 1. Then you can do q equal to 2, which is a rectangular case. And this is really interesting to me, at least, is that when you make n small on the rectangular lattice, you actually see very clearly a first order transition. Okay, so you see a big jump in the order parameter, you see a double peaked histogram. And now if you take the rectangular lattice and you make n larger, so I'm making the number of components larger, you actually see the first order transition go away. And you get very nice, this is Binder ratio, shows very nice crossing at the critical point, and this is collapse of both the order parameters for nail and valence bond solid very nicely at the critical point. And then if you take the honeycomb lattice, which corresponds to q equal to 3, you always see very nice continuous transitions in these models. So if I go and put all this now back in this phase diagram, we have lambda q for CPN, I can fill up each of these entries in this table, okay, and I can see that for n equal, so in our model, we can never study n equal to 1. Because the lowest symmetry we can have is SU2. We don't have any way of going n equal to 1. So we only study this region. But for the rectangular case, we actually see a transition from relevance to irrelevance. Okay, where relevance is basically implied by the fact that the transition is first order. Okay, and now the cases where it's continuous, we can study the critical exponents. And if they really are irrelevant, they should all flow to the CPN fixed point, right? And we can actually study, these are all our critical exponents extracted from our data. And this red line, again, is this 1 over n expansion. And we see that, you know, at least within the error of our numerical accuracy, the critical exponents are in relatively good agreement. It's not great, but it's very hard to extract critical exponents from numerical data. Okay, so basically, I'm done. I just want to give you a little outlook. So I showed you these new models that we can write down, which don't have a sign problem. And I like to think about this a lot. We have a systematic way of writing down all these Marshall positive models. And if you don't like SUN, you only like SU2 because you're familiar with spin operators, we have this general way of writing down this big family of models with SU2 symmetry that are sign problem free. So we can study any of these models. And we want to ask ourselves what ground state phases and critical points are accessible in these models. Okay, and can we prove at the level of a theorem that there's some phases which are too exotic to be realized in these models? Okay, so that's something I'm really interested in. And if not, you know, how do we, because there's so many parameters I can tune in these models, and you know, studying, even tuning one of these parameters takes a life of a grad student to study on a computer. It takes a lot of work. So the question we want to ask is, you know, we don't want to just send grad students doing these things without an idea. So do we have a strategy to tune these so we can study spin liquids and we can study critical points from spin liquids? And that's something we're thinking about a lot. And to show you that these models are just not, you know, just for curiosity, but they're actually useful for answering questions of curiosity on critical points, I showed you that we can study deconfined criticality. And I want to acknowledge Matt Block, my postdoc who did lots of the work that I showed you. And we have all kinds of evidence now, not just the fact that the transition is continuous, but we can actually extract critical exponents. We can study it in the large n limit. We can study it for different values of these q and n. Various things we can learn now about these gauge theories. So interesting thing now that we have all this evidence is we also want to think about how we can realize such phenomena in experiments. Okay, so that's what I want to say. Thank you. Breaks what?
So I'm wondering whether this sign-free condition means some
fine-tuning. So okay, I can try and answer. So I hope now that you know we have this picture in terms of loop models, whether you can try and understand in that language because. You could ask now, you know, maybe if you have loop models. Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that helps. But one positive thing I can say is to whatever extent it's been studied with DMRG, the J1, J2 model, which has a sign problem, seems to be relatively consistent with the continuous. So there's no evidence for first order transition, certainly. They've argued whether it's a spin liquid or VBS, but I think more and more as time progresses, it's looking like it's a valence bond solid. So at least there's one model, which, I don't know, it still has to be studied, but seems possible that we'll be able to answer that question. Now, it's an interesting question whether all, you know, this whole family of models is, so you can imagine that you can write down there's a whole family of SU2 models which have sign problems, and then there's this class of models which I'm telling you don't have a sign problem. Now, we don't know any way in which these models are special apart from the fact they don't have a sign problem. So we don't know the fact of whether they have some extra symmetry or whether they have something else which would make their physics different. So if you just believed in RG and you said that, you know, then symmetry and you know, only these general things determine RG flow diagrams, then your naive answer would be that it doesn't matter because it's just some microscopic way. It happens to be convenient to solve numerically. But we don't know anything more about it yet. But it's a great question. And I hope that, you know, that's one of the reasons we want to systematically find ways to write these models down is we hope that maybe we can try and prove something about this kind of models now. That's what I really want to do next.
I'm confused about the discussion with the lambda 4 where you talked about the physical model crossing the physical boundary.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that in the 80s, people look at, for example, the XY models and Heisenberg models where they put the Lagrange multiplier to completely quench the political defects. And I think the claim there was in three dimensions, for example, you get different political exponents. So the limit of the theory where you have multiple political defects is not the same as the UV model. So is it consistent with what you're saying, or is it something?
Yeah, so the limit where you have none of these topological defects is when you turn the fugacity to zero.
That's right.
So that's this point.
Yeah.
Now, you could always imagine, so then the question is.
Maybe I can rephrase. So you would, I guess your next slide, you have the line, the microscopic line crossing the critical surface. Then I guess what I'm saying is that if you consider, for example, in some
spin model where you would have no explicit quenching of the hedgehog or whatever, mm-hmm. you would get a different critical exponent, so you wouldn't flow to this different this critical point. You'd flow to the Wilson.
Right, absolutely. So, and it can happen. So as I, you know, that was the second part of the talk, where we're trying to determine which of these operators are relevant or irrelevant. So if it's relevant, actually this flows in the opposite direction. So then this line would not flow to this point, but flow away to that point. So the fact that this theory without topological defects appears in your lattice model, which has topological defects, relies on the fact that this operator happens to be irrelevant. So in those cases where it's relevant, it actually does flow to a different fixed point. Now, it may flow to a first order transition, but in one case we know, the SU2 case, it actually flows to the O3 point, which is like the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. So in that case, actually, the flow is like relevant and flowing to that fixed point. So that's why this irrelevance is very crucial to this whole deconfined criticality. That's why we wanted to test it in detail. So for SU2 or for any?
Say SU2.
Yeah, so I can show you. I mean, we have the data right here, right? So you can actually look at the numbers. So the SU2 is this point here. And I think that Sandvik originally thought that they were maybe the same. And since then, he thinks maybe they're slightly different. But it's very hard to determine critical exponents. They're certainly of the same order. So if I look over here, this looks like 0.39. And this might be something similar. So they happen to be very similar. But as you tune in, they certainly become very different. I mean, here it becomes 1.5. And this never crosses 0.7. So if they're the same, it's only for n equal to 2. And certainly not. So there's a theory I think maybe Sung Sik also worked on with Dirac fermions where these two anomalous dimensions are supposed to be the same, right? Yeah. Now, if you have a theory which is not the bosonic theory, but you have Dirac fermions, I think they're all supposed to be the same.
Yeah.
I think the critical, the no. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, that's another dream that we have, is that we hope by tuning these parameters, one day we can study that. So we have the bosonic fixed point with a U1 gauge theory, but we want to reach the point where we can study Dirac fermions with a U1 gauge theory. And there, I think the anomalous dimensions are supposed to be the same, right, between Nail and BBS. So, but I think in this bosonic theory, they're not supposed to be the same. There's some extra symmetry, yeah. Yeah. So here, there's no such symmetry.
You're saying they are
really well, certainly for n equal to 2, they happen to be numerically, numerically we just get a number. We don't know the analytic form of the number. And the numbers are very similar. But as a function of n, they certainly become very different numerically. So there's no reason to think that they might be the same for n equal to 2.
Do you believe philosophically that fermion theories of freedom can arise at an critical point in a model?
You know, I think Dirac fermions, it's possible. We're talking philosophically, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know what actually happens, but I think that Dirac fermions somehow are simpler than real, like maybe Fermi surfaces. So, I wouldn't be surprised if in these models you can't realize those spin liquids with real Fermi surfaces. But I feel optimistic that you can realize Dirac fermion spin liquids. So, I don't know. We have to. I don't think that Dirac fermion spin liquids are that exotic. But the real Fermi surface spin liquid, that I think is probably too exotic for this, but we might be wrong.
So
you mean with Dirac fermions? Yeah, no, it doesn't. People study, it's called staggered, that's what, you're talking about staggered fermions? Or,
yeah.
So people study. So, okay, of course, so what you could do is you could study explicitly Dirac fermions with a U1 gauge field. But we would like to study it as some spin model in which it's emergent. So people have tried to study that. And I don't know what the status of that is. So people do lattice simulations of They take a U1 gauge theory, just the whole. So I mean, even this, people have tried to simulate the this theory by putting it on a lattice. So you could take Dirac fermions and put it on a lattice and study it. And people try and study at what n you get confinement, or you know, the same thing that Tarun studies with his, but people try to answer it numerically. To get a spin model. Right. Yeah, you're right. I mean, you could imagine like you take some strong coupling limit or something of the theory, and you get some spin model. Now, unfortunately, most of the spin models you'll get will have sign problems. So, you know, I think Matthew and all did this, Lessig and Matthew did this for their D-waves Bose metal, and they get these ring exchange models, but they always come with the wrong sign for the sign problem. So that has Fermi surface. So it's interesting. You're saying that you could take the Dirac fermion and try and reverse engineer strong coupling and see if you can find a sign, one of these models or something close to one of these models. I think that's a great idea. Actually, that's so that maybe that I should, well, actually, maybe I should do that next. I think, I mean, it's, I'm not sure it'll work, but I think it's worth thinking about, because we want to think about what kind of interactions would stabilize that kind of spin liquid. Because if we can study that fixed point, I think that'll be really, really exciting to get all those numbers.
Do you think by going to a non-bipartite lattice, it makes these physics more accessible? Like, to what extent do you think limitations bipartite?
So there are different ways to answer that question. So I'm studying this model on the bipartite lattice. In fact, I was just telling Roger about that, and it actually it may not be what you want to ask about, because it may be So, you know, you can take this kind of singlet and study a singlet projector on the bipartite lattice. But now, because of bipartite lattice, it doesn't have SUN symmetry anymore. It has ON symmetry, because you can't stagger the, to get SUN symmetry, you have to stagger. Like on the A sublattice, you multiply by U. On the B sublattice, you multiply by U star. But if you take it uniform, you can always multiply by O, where O is an orthogonal matrix. And so the continuum theories of those are not CPN theories, but they're RPN theories. So you have real projective theories. And they have different physics. In fact, I believe that you can have a simple Z2 spin liquid in that case, because the Z2 deconfined phase is stable, unlike the U1 phase. So you can have you won't have a direct deconfined transition between Nail and BBS in that. And that's what I'm studying. And I think it's possible you have a spin liquid there. But okay, so now maybe maybe the question you're asking is what happens to a model like the Heisenberg model with SU2 symmetry or SUN symmetry on the non-bipartite lattice, right? That's the question that people want to know in condensed matter because of application to magnets and stuff, and that's much harder. And I have no idea how we can do that in Monte Carlo.
So the RP wave function on the non-bipartite lattices.
I see.
You have the wave functions, but I mean, it's kind of a step. So the wave function, the sign problem of the wave functions is solved. It's like the simplest first step. So maybe that can be translated. Maybe there's some hope there. Anyway, we've got to let you go because.